This is the Baymaw Podcast with Marty Solomon. I'm his co-host Brent Billings. Today we are with Reed Dent to compare and contrast Psalms 51 and 139.
Yeah, what's up?
What's up? We're back.
Another one of these. Yeah, we got another one of these sets of notes in front of me, and I can't believe what I'm looking at here. I can't believe
why.
Well, I can't believe you found scripture gold. I can't believe that, Reed. I figured you had to depend on me to do that for you.
Wow. Only you, Marty.
Shots
only you
fired.
Only you can both compliment and completely insult me in the same breath.
And literally, it's only you I can do it with. I don't think I can do it with anybody else. Maybe my wife, but I'm not even sure I can do it on the level with the ease with which it comes to me.
Okay.
Whenever we get together like this, I just love it. But no, this is great. I can't even believe this. I'm going to really look forward to chatting about this.
Okay.
I'm sure it won't be. This looks very academic, is what I'm seeing. A very academic conversation. I'm sure there won't be any.
Nothing personal.
Deep emotional feels in this conversation. I feel very safe right now. I'm looking at very academic, lofty, heady thoughts.
It is the Psalms. It is the Psalms. How could we possibly be emotional or vulnerable? Okay, I think the best thing to do is just we're going to start with Psalm 139, and I like to just let's take it all in. So, Brent, can you read it just from top to bottom?
This part at the beginning, for the director of music of David, a psalm, is that's in the biblical text, right?
Correct.
Yes, that's in the manuscripts. Yep.
I think when I was younger, I just assumed those were like extra notes, and so I just. And I was pretty sure they were in the manuscripts, but
yep.
Just wanted to like say that out loud.
No, it's in the text, in the manuscripts. It's worth noting that there could be some ambiguity about the of David or the a Psalm of David. It could mean that David is the author of the Psalm. It could also mean in the spirit of David, by some other author. It's hard to know exactly. I'm taking it as the way that I'm reading it for the purpose of this episode is basically just, well, I don't really care about the distinction, but it's by David. It's from him. So we can read it that way. But yeah.
I share that assumption. I've even heard people make the case that it could be a psalm for David, even though in the Hebrew there's a way to say that. Mm-hmm. But I've heard people try to make that case. But I think I too usually hear that as a psalm. That David wrote, or at least is written in his voice.
Right.
So yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Okay, enough with the academics. Here we go.
Thank you.
Not enough. Brent, there's more academia to be dove into. We don't have to say.
No more hiding behind your shield. No more hiding behind your shields of academia, Marty. It's time to get personal.
You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. If only you, God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting.
Oh, I love this psalm. I love this psalm so much. Also, Brent, very well read. That was great.
I tried to know, make it a little more emotional, a little less academic.
I hated it. I hated it.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew it. There is so much that could be said about this psalm. Actually, when we did the psalms last year at CCF, instead of doing a bunch of different psalms for my part over the course of the semester, I just preached this same psalm 4 different times because I love it so much and because there's a ton that could be said about it. But we're going to keep this a little bit shorter. So we're not going to go into everything, but
can we link to some of those sermons, Reed? Are they available?
Well, 2 of them are parts 1 and 4. The hard part is actually the one that's on this particular thing we're going to talk about today was part 2. 2 and 3 didn't get recorded because of some technical mishaps, because I need you to come to Missouri and do all of our recording here so that doesn't happen. We can link to parts 1 and 4, but
we'll link what's available.
Yeah. It's very, very sad to me that 2 and 3 got cut out, because it's meant to be a continuous 1 through 4 thing, but whatever.
It's just like some of Paul's letters. We don't have all Paul's letters.
Oh,
we know there's at least one more letter to the Corinthians that we don't
stop being academic, Brent. Stop being academic.
Sorry.
I love this psalm, and I like vibe with it all the way through. How precious to me are your thoughts. When I awake, I'm still with you. And then, did anybody else feel what I felt when you get to verse 19 that begins, "If only you, God, would slay the wicked"? Does anybody else feel shocked there?
I felt different when I was reading it.
Yeah. One of these things is not like the other.
There's like so much like comfort and security and knowing, like it feels like I'm in the womb when I am hearing this. And it's comfortable and it's safe and everything is right. And then suddenly we're talking about killing people and people who are bloodthirsty and hating people. I have nothing but hatred for them in verse 22. There's another rendering of that I read that was, "I hate them with complete hatred." I think that's Alter's translation of it. Have you guys ever hated somebody with complete hatred? Well, I guess my first question is, shouldn't, like, am I weird for being like, David, are you sure? Like, I don't think we should hate people. What's going on here? Like, should it be okay to hate people who hate God? Like, is there a voice that would say, shouldn't we yearn for like the people who slander and rebel against God, and they're saying bad things about him, and they're misusing his name? Like, shouldn't we want them to be defeated? Aren't they the enemy? Shouldn't we hate them? Should it be okay to hate people who hate God? That's my question for you.
Well, I can. That first question about have I ever hated someone with complete hatred is a harder one. These next questions that you ask, it that's a little bit easier for me to connect the dots to. I can think of names and faces and whatever, and I can go, okay, have I rooted for their defeat? Mm-hmm. I've gotten pretty, yeah. I think I would always just chalk it up to what we talked about in the intro episode about the Psalms, like, this is part of what I feel, but I think there's another Jesus part of me that's like, but that's not where the story ends. Like, that's not all the feelings. Like, I can't just yearn for their defeat and that's it. Mm-hmm. I can be honest about how I long for their defeat, but then I also have to recognize like their image of godness and all that. So I think I argue with myself. Mm-hmm. I can at least relate to those last ones. Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially that one about yearning for the defeat of those who slander and rebel against God. Yeah.
Yeah. And it does feel like that question is, yeah, but then when we get into the territory of, I hate them with complete hatred, it feels, I don't know, it just feels really uncomfortable. And when I think about this in the abstract, like if I do the scholarship thing and I think, okay, well, who is David writing about? Like, who are the wicked that he is wanting to be slain? Who are the bloodthirsty that he is wanting to get as far away as possible from? Then it's like, okay, well, I can think of he had enemies or Saul or whoever, people who are out to get him, and he's and it's like makes it a little more palatable. I hold it at arm's length. But then I think about, like, if this psalm is going to, if I'm going to use it as my own kind of language or experience, like, there, I think I have to think, well, are there people like who I have not just yearned for their defeat, but are there people that I have, you know, I've wished that they would just depart from me as far as possible, or even that God would kill them? Are there people that I have really hated? Like, do I have enemies? And suddenly the psalm, like, it gets way more personal, and it, I don't know, it gets really hard to grapple with for me, because I think my honest answer is maybe not as much as some people, but yes, I think I felt that way about someone else. But I don't want to feel that way about them. But then when I go back to, like, well, why do I feel that way? I feel like I get kind of plunged back into it, and I just see, like, this enemy in front of me, and it's like, well, if I'm being really honest, yeah, this is what I feel. I don't know. What do you think, Brent? Have you ever had an experience like that with another person?
Yeah. Brent, what do you think?
I'll get to you, Marty.
Well, I don't think I've ever hoped for someone to be slain, mm-hmm. necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think I can think of, you know, a pretty good number of examples where I'm like, I wish I would never see that person again, or never hear from that person again, or whatever, whether that's somebody in my life or, you know, more of a public figure type who's just a little too whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the idea of hoping for their defeat feels much more accurate to mm-hmm. my general feelings when it's in this sort of realm.
Right.
But I don't know. Do I not hate? Yeah, I guess sometimes I do hate, because it's like, why do they have to keep being like this?
Right.
So, yeah.
And even if you don't literally want them to be slain, like, it can be exaggerated language, right? I mean, it can be something that you say because it captures an intensity of, like, a feeling you're having, even if you don't really want that thing to happen. But the point is, like, just that intensity of hatred, or substitute another word if hate is like a four-letter word for you to say, I don't know what that would be. This, like, detesting of somebody else. I don't know. Marty, do you have any experience with this?
I mean, I can relate to it. Yeah. I'm not sure if I were honest that I can say I'm consciously aware of, like, I get the sense here in the Psalms, not just this one, but others, that, like, David or whoever the psalmist, like, really feels this with an intensity that, probably because of my privilege and the life that I've lived and mm-hmm. how little I've tasted of oppression, I have not probably.
Yeah.
But I can relate to some of these things. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it is. Yeah, I think the word hatred is hard, probably because of the way I've just been trained and
right.
just so discipled in the love of Jesus that I...
Which I was going to say, that's not a bad thing. Like, yeah, if hatred right. is hard, that's actually good.
Yeah.
Because the, you know, discipled in the love of Jesus should root these things out of us over time. I hope that it would. But at the very least, even if what we feel towards another is not intense hatred, like, would it be fair to say that there is definitely, like, a tendency for us with people that really make us angry or have really hurt us to kind of other them, and we put them in, like, a category of humanity that we
100%.
Ourselves don't inhabit?
Absolutely. No doubt.
And so the wicked or the bloodthirsty or the evil ones, they're like not like me, you know?
Right.
I mean, that's fair to say, right?
Yep.
And so David is feeling this intensity towards whoever these others are, these wicked people, these bloodthirsty people. And it's still kind of weird to me that this exists in this psalm. I don't claim to understand it. Like, why are we moving from how precious to me are your thoughts, O God, and this whole sense of like tranquility and being known and this love to that God would slay the wicked? Like, I don't really get that. But then in my study of this, there is a particular thing that David says here in verse 19 about being bloodthirsty. That kind of triggered something in the recesses of my brain. And so I want to move from this part, from Psalm 139, to 2 Samuel 11. You guys know what's in 2 Samuel 11? I bet you do.
Is this the Bathsheba story?
You bet it is. Which is something that this is a story that we know, a lot of us. This is a Bible story that is quite popular. For anybody who maybe doesn't know, the gist of the story is this, that, David sees a woman that he desires. Her name is Bathsheba, and he wants to be with this woman, but there's a hitch in the plan, and that is that she is married. And she is married to this man named Uriah, who happens to be a soldier in David's army. The problem is not that David wants her, but that he actually goes and he sleeps with her, and that she becomes pregnant. And now it's really a problem because there's no hiding this. And Uriah is like, she is married to this guy, Uriah, and David is really in a bad way. He's in a jam here, to say the least. I know I'm being kind of flippant about it. But he realizes, oh, wait, I'm the king. I can take care of this problem. And so, he orders Uriah and the other soldiers, that are with him to the front line of a battle, but then secretly orders the other soldiers to retreat so that Uriah is left there alone with the enemy. And of course, he dies. And there's another psalm that actually is written in specifically like in response to this whole situation. So this happens, and you guys remember there's a prophet, Nathan, who comes to David. And we talked about this in the parable series, where he comes to David and he tells this story about a guy who's got this one little lamb, and there's a rich guy who's got everything in the world, and the rich guy takes the guy's one little lamb that he loves. It's his most prized and only possession, and he takes it and he kills it. And Nathan is like, what do you think about this? And David's like, we got to get that guy. And then Nathan says, you're the man. And so Nathan confronts him. Basically, it's a parable that he tells to make him realize his guilt about the whole Bathsheba, Uriah situation. And then in Psalm 51, it begins with this note. When the prophet Nathan came to him after David had committed adultery with Bathsheba. Let's go ahead and read this then. This is what David writes in response to being confronted with that situation. Brent, can you read Psalm 51?
Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you, you only, have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. So you are right in your verdict and justified when you judge. Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. Yet you desired faithfulness even in the womb. You taught me wisdom in that secret place. Cleanse me with hyssop, and I will be clean. Wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones you have crushed rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquity. Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me from your presence or take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. Then I will teach transgressors your ways, so that sinners will turn back to you. Deliver me from the guilt of bloodshed, O God, you who are God, my Savior. And my tongue will sing of your righteousness. Open my lips, Lord, and my mouth will declare your praise. You do not delight in sacrifice, or I would bring it. You do not take pleasure in burnt offerings. My sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit. A broken and contrite heart you, God, will not despise. May it please you to prosper Zion, to build up the walls of Jerusalem. Then you will delight in the sacrifices of the righteous, in burnt offerings offered whole. Then bulls will be offered on your altar.
Once again, well read, Brent.
Another strange turn at the end. Like,
yeah,
it was all so like personal and reflective. And then it's like about the city.
Extremely different tone from Psalm 139. Very, very different vibe. But did you hear it? This is what got triggered for me in the recesses of my brain when I was reading the bit about if only you would slay the wicked, O God. There's a word that popped up in there that's like a pretty stark, powerful kind of word that I've got underlined there in the notes. But I wonder if you guys did you catch it when we were reading through in Psalm 139, our at peace in the love of God psalm that takes this turn. David says, away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. And then in Psalm 51, same psalm, or not, different psalm, same author, you have, deliver me from the guilt of bloodshed, O God. And I got curious, and so I went to looking, and it would be great if Elle were here to give me an expert opinion, but this word about you who are bloodthirsty and the guilt of bloodshed, those are the same, they're the same word. And I was like, oh, it's David in both cases, except for on the one hand, you have him saying, away from me, like, I wish these guys were dead. These bloodthirsty men who are after me. And then in the other case, you have him saying, deliver me from the guilt of bloodshed. He has become the bloodthirsty one. And maybe I was like imagining Uriah out there on the battlefield, realizing what was happening to him, that he was being set up and abandoned. And I thought, I just imagined him being the one to write the words of Psalm 139. And if he had written those words, those specifically those verses 19 through 22, if he had written, if only you, God, would slay the wicked, away from me, you who are bloodthirsty, who would he have been talking about? And of course, he would have been talking about David. And he would have been perfectly justified, I think, because David is the one who is after him and was sending him to his death. And it struck me as so powerful that these two psalms, not just different tones, right? But different, not just different emotional registers, but different roles. Like David in Psalm 51 has become the very person that he was crying out against in Psalm 139. That these two psalms could paint a picture of a person, David, that is this kind of complexity, this kind of nuanced, which then makes sense to me why. And we talked about this in the introduction, right? We got to be careful not to like absolutize and take certain statements out of the Psalms and just make them like concrete doctrines. That's not what I'm trying to do. So when you have something like you knitted me together in my mother's womb in Psalm 139, and then in Psalm 51, you have I was brought forth in iniquity and in sin did my mother conceive me. I don't think this is David trying to like put forth some kind of absolute like abstract theological picture of the nature of being a person. I think it is him writing out of the place that he is in, which on the one hand comes from a place of I'm being pursued, people are after me, but I'm trusting in the love of God. And in the other hand comes from I've just been confronted with the fact that I have done this to another person. And so both of these statements are absolutely true, and they're coming from this like deep, personal, lived experience that David has. And so if I ask the question, is David a victim or is David a perpetrator? Or if I ask the question, is David a hero or a villain, or is he a good guy or a bad guy? These kinds of binaries that make it easy. Like, we like to paint the world in these kinds of it's this or that kind of thing. It makes it easy for us to then say, I hate them with complete hatred because they're something different than me, right? But if I ask, is David a good guy or a bad guy? The answer is yes. Yes. Is he a victim or a perpetrator? Yes. Is he a hero or a villain? Yes. Which brings up this line from Alexander Solzhenitsyn that I heard, I don't know, I may have even, I heard it from Fleming Rutledge in her book, The Crucifixion, but I think it's been talked about on the podcast before. But Solzhenitsyn said, the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart. I remember the first time I read that, it hit me like a lightning bolt that was, yes. And I don't have to look any farther than my own self to know that this is true, right? To know that the problem is not always out there and it's all everybody against me, but that I am the problem too. Does that, are you guys registering with that? Does that speak to like your own experience as well?
Well, I'll start with the academic and then I'll try to move towards the personal. Because I think I see this theme in, like, I think it was in session two, and I talked about Psalm 109, how almost within the same psalm itself, there's this movement, because the grammar is all, the pronouns, like, everything's, it reads just like a, like, David's just crying out for deliverance, and he's in the right, and I think the psalm is written as a reflection on the Abigail story. That's my conviction, but I can't necessarily defend that or prove it, but. But then when you start to pay closer and closer attention to the language, it seems that the psalm is actually doing the same reflection. Like, when you start reading it, you're like crying out against your enemies, looking for vengeance and vindication. By the time you're done, you're realizing the psalm's really about me, because this is what people actually say about me. And so I'm going to give this over to you, God, because I need your grace and your mercy as much as they do, and they need it as much as I do. So I feel like this is a movement that David often makes. When you ask personally, I can absolutely say that. I'm not sure I could have said it without a certain level of life experiences, and I don't think I would have had this awareness for all my life. I don't think this would have been a truth I would have easily gotten my hands on, which I think is what makes it so important and so relevant and deep for a world today that wants to push things into that those binaries. We want to push it into a cancel culture from whatever side we stand on. This is a bad person. These are good people. And this conversation just illumines, like, that's not really how it works.
Brent, you got any thoughts?
I was such a staunch absolutist in almost every way until probably my late 20s. Yeah. Wrestling with
then what happened?
Complication. Well, then I got into Bema, and there were some cracks starting to form before I got into Bema, and Bema is what kind of threw the whole thing wide open.
I happened to read Dent.
He finally had an enemy, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because I think my feelings about the world are even stronger than they were before, because I've seen so many more situations play out where I'm like, that's terrible. That person shouldn't do that. That person shouldn't be like that. And yet I'm also like in this knowledge base of experience and new perspective where I can see, oh, it's more complicated than that. It's not a simple yes or no, black or white, hero or villain, good or bad. Like, it's all mixed in together.
Or maybe even to say it more, not as a counterpoint, not as an argument, but as I'm thinking about how I'm hearing that, Brent, not even either or, but just I have been both. Because I think there are moments where, and everybody has been both, like there are moments where, like, it's not always like this nuanced, crazy, complex. Like, sometimes I have squarely been a victim, and sometimes I have squarely been the offender, like, squarely, without a whole lot of complexity. And yet the story itself is complex and nuanced. Like, David was absolutely in that story, totally the offender and the wrong, the abuser, the sinner. And yet, and then when I realized that about myself, well, it helps me realize, well, my enemies have kids too. I was just talking with my spiritual director this last week, and he was talking about the song by, I think it was a song by Sting years ago, that the lyric that says, you know, our greatest hope is that the Russians love their children too. And just what a powerful lyric that was back then when he performed it in Moscow. And Moscow, Russia, that is. And so that's what kept coming to mind from this last week's reflection with my spiritual director, was in similar veins of it is actually harder. Your heart wants to categorize people, especially in the world we're seeing right now, heroes and villains, good guys and bad guys. Good biblical perspective would tell us in the larger picture, maybe not in the moment, but in the larger picture, it's a little bit more complex than that.
Yeah. Which is, it's really challenging because I have to take a good hard look at when the shoe is on the other foot and I'm the offender. But I think there's also some kind of comfort that can be gained from it, and knowing that I am my enemy and my enemy is me to some extent, you know, not in the particulars, but in this broader sense of what it is to be a person, that this is something that is shared. I think this is the thing that enables us. I mean, I talk to people who are angry with someone else and they just don't have a way of moving past that anger. And I think that this sense of we have this thing in common, that we're both at times the offender, and that we're both at times the one who is being offended, that the recognition that I am like them and they are like me is the thing that enables anger to kind of be transmuted into compassion. But as long as I see them as the wicked, as long as I'm only reading Psalm 139 that says they are bloodthirsty, and I'm not reading Psalm 51 that says, deliver me from my bloodthirstiness, then I think it's impossible to actually make a move toward them, even if you desire it. You know, you have to see you, yourself, and them for who they really are.
And in this challenge is a great representation of the whole thing we talked about in the intro about how you can't simplify the Psalms, because we got to be, like, for all those people that are sitting there going, are you saying that it's okay because we're all offenders and we're all offendees, that it just doesn't matter? And the answer to that is absolutely not. Like, those things are, there's deep consequences.
Of course.
To abuse. There's deep consequences to offenses, especially some offenses even more than others. And we're not saying, like, well, we're always the offender and we're always the offendees. And so that's why you can't take one psalm and the challenge of one conversation and say, this encapsulates the whole experience. And yet this challenge is super, super critical. And it's a part of this larger thing that we can find in the Psalms that's so helpful for us.
Yeah, I mean, just we're not saying it as an excuse. Just read the rest of the Psalms, like the rest of Psalm 139 and the rest of Psalm 51.
Read the other 148.
No, read the rest of these two Psalms and see, like, how deeply these different experiences are being felt by the same person.
Right.
Like, it goes all the way down. It's not an excuse for anything. It's just grappling with the truth of these two sides of being a person. And it's not... To me, it's not just the simple fact These psalms aren't just here to be like, well, sometimes you're the good guy and sometimes you're the bad guy. But what I love about these psalms is how rich of a picture they paint of the experience of being both of these things.
Right.
To me, like when I read these two psalms next to each other, I'm like, this is the whole thing, man. This is like the whole experience of being a person. Like we already said, like we're all victims, we're all perpetrators, the bloodthirsty thing, right? We're all men of blood and are being pursued by men of blood. We all hate our enemies. And yet we also, like, at some point live long enough, and you'll have a Uriah too, probably, maybe not to like that level of intensity, but somebody who would say, man, that guy, like, look what he did to me, you know, or look at the way that he treated me or the way that he talked to me. Like, we're on both sides. Look at, I mean, just some of the things here that I've highlighted in the notes from these two psalms in compare and contrast, right? It's not just the word bloodthirsty, but it goes throughout the psalms, really. I think there's like these two sides. Like, let me see here. We've got 139. You've got, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. And then in Psalm 51, it's, hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquity. And so on the one hand, you know, it's this not being hidden is a comfort, right? To be known and fully seen by God is something that is immensely comforting. And yet, on the other hand, it's like we also all know, like, I'd rather you not look at this part. Here's the thing I don't want you to see. Hide your face from this part of me. But of course, the truth is that God sees it all. Like, he sees the whole thing.
I'll do my favorite. My favorite is in Psalm 139, like, you can't get away from God's spirit. Mm-hmm. Where can I go to get away from you? Where can I flee from your presence? Mm-hmm. I can't go here. I can't go there. I can't go here. I can't go there. You'll always be with me. And then in Psalm 51, he's asking, do not cast me away from your presence or take your Holy Spirit from me. So another very like almost opposing ideas.
Right. I mean, it's this experience, like, we know what it is. To feel, again, the security, right? That there's nowhere that I can go that God is not going to find me. And there is an immense amount of peace that can come from that. But we also all know these moments where we feel like we're in imminent danger of being finally thrown away by God once and for all, because here's the thing that I did, and now he's going to like toss me out. And so please, please don't, you know?
You already mentioned the inmost being. I was created, you know, you created me in my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb, mm-hmm. versus the surely. It's almost like Reed, I feel like almost literally, I feel like he had a copy of this great song, like maybe one of his favorite songs. And it's almost like he pulled it out at this time of realization and reflection and wrote an anti-psalm to the psalm he originally wrote in his own self-reflection. Because it's not just a couple references.
Right.
Like, you've pulled out four or five clear, like, antithesis statements between these psalms. Mm-hmm. Almost like he's deconstructing his written, not devalidating, just saying, okay, there's this other side of me I've seen in the mirror.
Right.
And I'm going to take this highest moment and I'm going to unpack it in one of my lowest moments.
Yeah. I mean, 139 and verse 2, you know when I sit and when I rise, you perceive my thoughts from afar. And then in 51 verse 3, for I know my transgressions and my sin is always before me. And I think, yeah, there I know what it is that, like, God sees me no matter where I am. Like, what God sees is, and like, we can acknowledge, right? Like, he's got his eye on me. And that also at the same time, what I know about myself, what's always before me when I look at myself, is my own sin. Like, yeah, that's what God sees. But also there's this, and I can't get over it, this sense of penetrating remorse, I guess. Yep. Realizing this is what I've done. You know what I'm saying?
Yep. Yep.
You see any other ones in there?
It's almost like the stanzas carry the theme. So, and you've identified one phrase in almost every stanza of the psalm that carries over to a response in the other psalm.
I'm looking at 139 and 51 verses 15 and 9, respectively. My frame was not hidden from you. And then in 51, you have, hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquity, which is not as much of a contrast as I would have thought from the other ones, because David isn't actually asking to have his whole self hidden from God. He's not saying, I'm evil. He said in verse 4, I have sinned and done what is evil. So you're right in your verdict and justified when you judge. But he's not asking to be hidden from God because he thinks he's evil. He's saying, I've done this evil. I've committed this sin. So cleanse me and create in me a clean heart. Renew my spirit. Restore me. It's an interesting perspective that he is able to recognize, like, oh, it is not the fundamental nature of who I am that I need to be completely cut off and hidden from God. He's saying, hide your face from my sins. Like, can we just get rid of that? Can we move past that? Like, that's his yearning.
Yeah. I mean, I just think there are some times where not being hidden, where God, being familiar with all of our ways, right? Before a word is on our tongue, God knows it completely. There are some times where that is something that we rest in. And there are other times, like in Psalm 51 with the hide your face, where it's not so comforting, right? Where it feels almost like it's there's like an anxiety or a threat to us about it, you know, in that moment that we're feeling that kind of remorse. Yeah. I think then, you know, what is the, like, where are we going to wrap this up? What are we going to walk away with here?
I want you to read the last paragraph of your notes. I don't even care that you're reading it. I just want you to read it because it's so good.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about leading into this last thing in my notes. What is the picture of God that we get in both of these psalms, in both of these very different experiences, one of comfort and one of dismay? Like, what do we see of God? And I said God creates each person in mercy, and God sees the whole truth of you, from your beloved creation being knit together in the womb, to your darkest moments, not just on a timeline from past to future. He's not watching it in sequence, left to right, but he sees it all at once. He sees the whole of it. From the being knit together to the time that you sent Uriah out onto the battlefield. Like, he sees all of that all at once, and he doesn't hate. He doesn't condemn. He doesn't give up. Honestly, like, in truth, he sees the horror. He sees how we are prey to it, the horror that is done to us from other people, and he is near to us when men of blood surround us, but he also sees when we play a part in it. And his response to that is that he renews the spirits. He restores the joy of those who come back home because, as the gospel tells us, where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more.
Zapow!
Zapow! So I would encourage listeners, sit down with these two psalms side by side. Like, look at it for yourself. I really do think there's a lot to be mined here. Think about how it resonates with you now or in the past or in the future. Well, I guess you can't think about how it resonates with you in the future, but you know what I mean? as you take stock of your own life, and try to take a good look at the honest whole, see what these psalms can tell you about yourself and what they can tell you about, the God who is there watching that self, being near to that self.
And I would encourage people to sit with it for, I don't know, a week, like, read both of these every day for a week or a month, even.
For sure.
Like, really dwell on it, because as you go through different parts of life, you get more familiar with these elements, with these feelings. And then if you're in it, then you're going to start to recognize things in your life that fit into these different parts. And you're like, oh, I do have that hatred sometimes. I do feel like God should hide his face from my sin because it's so egregious. I do, like, yeah, all these things. So that familiarity and that recognition, yeah, is good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that does it for this episode.
Okay.
So you can go to BayamonaStampShop.com. We'll have a couple of things in the show notes for this. Check out all of the things there. Get in touch with us. And yeah, I'm feeling a little too reflective to do my normal outro, but just, yeah, thanks for joining us on this journey on the Baymont podcast, and we'll talk to you again soon.